Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is going to be an empowering hour. We're going to give you the latest on health and healing and why the omega-3 fatty acids are so important to predict death risks, more so than cholesterol, and a lot more. Then we're going to have a guest in the second part of our program. The guest is going to talk about the environmental deregulation nightmare under the Trump administration and the EPA. And that is Winona Hodder, who's executive director of Food and Water Watch out of Washington, D.C. Also, I'm going to do a commentary on the most important issues that we're not addressing on any level, and we should, because we avoid them, we engage in hubris at our own peril. But we are engaged in identity politics, and right now our universities and colleges, not all, but many of the Ivy League, have a small group of people, could be 5 to 10%, who are of the opinion that if you have a different point of view, you should not be allowed to share that with anyone. And we believe that we should respect freedom of speech, just like we should select freedom of choice. So this way we have a choice. Want to take your cancer to an orthodox doctor? Fine. But what if you went on an alternative? What if there was no option? You only could do one, not the other. That's tyranny, and that's what we're seeing all around us. But it is coming slowly into our consciousness. We're being conditioned that this is okay, and we're simply saying it is not. Today you're going to hear an interesting dialogue, a debate between two individuals on this topic, two of the best that I could find. Frank Bruni of the New York Times and Professor Jonathan Haidt, that's H-A-I-D-T, New York University. They're both going to talk about what's going on right now in universities. Who's behind it? What's their motive? What's their end game? And how is it causing teachers across the United States to fear that anything they may say in class could be putting them on to a trial in secret, where they cannot bring in an attorney? And this is rampant. So we're going to deal with that. Also today, I promised you a debate between two feminists. They have different perspectives on what feminism means and the empowerment of women. And I believe that these are two voices. There are many others. Now, you could agree or disagree with any part of either of them, but it's important that we hear what they have to say and then decide, how does this empower women? How does this empower men? We want equality for men and women. Any responsible, reasonable, spiritual, and humanistic person wants to see both men and women given every opportunity, not deprived, not relegated to some artificial role. But right now, there's a real bashing of men and young boys. People want to feminize. A certain group wants to feminize young boys. And I believe this is also part of what we're being exposed to. So we're going to offer some counterpoints of view. All that's today. So let's begin. We always start with the latest on health and healing. And I also want us to know that we're not taking enough omega-3 fatty acids. Almost every single person that comes to my office that I counsel when we see their nutrient profile, they're dehydrated. Most people don't realize how much water you actually should be consuming. They generally have magnesium deficiency, calcium deficiency. I just got word that someone fell and broke a lot of bones in their body. And then they thought that it was because of the, you know, they fell down and broke their bones. And because of this person's health, I'm willing to bet that they had severe osteoporosis, in which case, and this is the majority of situations, a person's bones crack, and because of the bones collapsing and cracking and breaking, they fall down. Now, they may injure some other bones, but generally when you fall down, you don't break, you know, 10 bones in your body. And if I were to do a nutritional profile on this person, I know I'm going to find multiple nutritional deficiencies. Calcium at the top of the list, boron at the top of the list. But also, what's behind a lot of our overall health problems? A lack of omega-3 fatty acids. Now, we need omega-3 fatty acids every day. Depends upon your state of health. If you're very healthy, you could get by with 1,500 to 2,000 milligrams a day. But what if you're sick? What if you've had multiple problems, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, atherosclerosis, dementia? That means you have massive amounts of inflammation. That means you're going to have to take more. Now, this is from the Journal of Clinical Lipidology, and it says that omega-3 levels better predictors of death risks than serum cholesterol. Now, the recent study that was published in the peer-reviewed journal looked at the value of measuring blood levels of EPA and DHA from the omega-3 fatty acids to assess an individual's risk of developing certain diseases. And they found that when you have a low red blood cell membrane count of the omega-3 fatty acids, you are far more likely to develop different diseases and die from those diseases. So whether it's cardiovascular disease or cancer. So here's the takeaway message. Make sure that every day, either through vegan sources, like the essential fatty acids you can get in some of the vegan preparations, like a teaspoon, or from fish oil, make sure that you get between 2,000 to 5,000 units of vitamin, the omega-3 fatty acids every day. Now, a separate study from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology went a little further, and they found that these same omega-3 fatty acids provide potent anti-inflammatory effects. So awareness of the benefits of the omega-3 fatty acids is now beginning, at least with this audience and other health-minded people, to rise. And certainly the omega-3 supplements have been shown to help people counter the negative effects of heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, and many forms of cancer. Simply put, the health-boosting benefits of the omega-3s largely comes from its anti-inflammatory properties. Yet for all the studies conducted on omega-3s, over 1,000 that I'm aware of, there has been some confusion regarding how they work and why they're so effective. And it isn't always clear if they are effective across the board with everyone or if results vary from one individual to another. I can only tell you that everyone that I put the omega-3 fatty acids into their diet, I'm putting them in different combinations at a higher doses than what I would recommend over the air. And there's a simple reason for that. Because if you're sitting across from me, you may have six different diseases. All six of those could kill you. Heart disease, high blood pressure, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, congestive lung conditions. All those are killers. Well, they all have something in common. All of those are pro-inflammatory, meaning the more inflammation that's in your system, the faster you're going to progress to an end stage or death. So the very first thing we want to do is turn off the inflammation. And therefore, I would start at a higher dose. Now, I don't tell people that because some people misconstrue what I say, and they'll say, oh, yeah, Gary said that to take this amount every day of this supplement. No. When I tell you suggested amounts, those are not for disease. Those are for people to maintain good health. for disease, it's very individual. So now when you start putting the omega-3 fatty acids in and other oils, I would put coconut oil in there, absolutely, and olive oil, and flaxseed oil. And if they, again, you don't want to overdo the oils. You want the complex carbohydrates to be a primary source of nutrition, and you don't want excessive calories. And remember, all oils are fats, and all fats give you twice the number of calories, 8 calories per gram versus 4 for carbohydrates and protein. So a lot of people going on some of these health diets get overweight because they're not looking at how much fat they're taking in, the good fats. But then you want to turn off inflammation, and the best things to turn off inflammation, the three best things you can take. Now, I don't care whether you have arthritis or macular degeneration or glaucoma or dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, the three best. Number one, it's in a class by itself, and that is black cumin seed oil. Generally 1 teaspoon in the morning if you're healthy, and then you'll have to have your healthcare provider tell you how many to take if you're not. Curcumin, generally 2,000 milligrams, but if you have cancer, I'm going to way up that. And heart disease, the same. Alzheimer's, dementia, the same. Again, what you need if you're very sick, you're going to have to get counseled for by your healthcare provider. And number three, and this is important, is cayenne. Cayenne is one of those universal adaptogenic herbs. It can help your blood pressure, can help microcirculation to the brain. Boy, you need that for helping keep your neurons healthy and nourished. Your extremities to help get the blood that could be slowing down as you age from pumping back up through the valves, and it stagnates there. You don't want that. You get those little purple veins in the ankles and the feet and the legs. Cayenne helps with that. Cayenne is just... It turns off inflammation tremendously. So those would be the top three. Now then, number four would be the omega-3 fatty acids. So that's important. Also, we're now seeing in a German cancer research center that high blood glucose levels is possibly an effect rather than the cause of diabetes. And once again, we have to look at inflammation as being the primary cause and raising your blood sugar as the secondary cause. Now, why would I say that? Because insulin resistance and elevated blood glucose levels are considered to be the cause of type 2 diabetes. However, scientists from the German Cancer Research Center and Heidelberg University Hospital have now provided evidence that things might be completely different. They showed in their studies that the levels of metabolic MG, which is methylated glycosol, cause the typical diabetic disturbances of the metabolism and lead to insulin resistance and obesity and elevated blood sugar and hence diabetes. Now, type 2 diabetes, a form of diabetes with a typical onset in middle or older age, causes severe health complications, including elevated risk of heart disease and strokes, massive blood flow problems in the legs, as well as severe damage to the eyes, the kidneys. And one of the best ways of helping kidney disease is to get them on a plant-based diet with lots of green juices, but watching the potassium levels and watching the protein levels. Well, a plant-based diet doesn't elevate protein. It's not high levels of protein, which you do not need. You're far healthier. You're going to live a longer life if your kidneys and your liver are not overproducing through deamidization the urea and ammonia, which are the byproducts of the animal breakdown of protein. And yet a lot of diabetics take a lot of animal protein, way more than what they need. Under one of these myths, oh, you need protein to check your blood sugar level. You can do the same thing with low glycemic foods, meaning they slowly release the sugar in the bloodstream so you don't have these spikes. Well, these dangerous late effects are believed to be caused by high blood sugar, which develops when the body's cells no longer respond to insulin, the regulatory hormone that lowers blood sugar. But blood glucose levels correlate with the levels of diabetic symptoms. And when very high blood glucose levels are lowered using drugs, the rate of infarctions and strokes, as well as blood flow, decrease in parallel. But this holds true only up to a certain point. And large clinical trials in recent years have shown, even when blood sugar could be lowered by drugs below the diabetic threshold value, many patients nevertheless develop typical diabetes damage to nerves and kidneys. And this suggests that type 2 diabetes might in fact have molecular causes that are independent of insulin and glucose. Now, from my own perspective, I never saw a single person growing up who lost weight as they got older, especially middle-aged, but rather they gained weight. They became sedentary. They believed that the older you were, and older back then was in your 50s, because the lifespan back then was only in the late 60s, and if a person lived to be 65, you were and died, you considered living a long life. But you have to put three things into context. Everyone back in the 1940s, 50s smoked. Social drinking was a norm. It had been enculturated into our mindset that if you have someone over, you have to have a bar set up and you give them, depending upon what their preference was, which is rather ironic. I'll tell you how susceptible we are to conditioning. I had a group of people over for a New Year's Eve party, and every year for 20 years when I lived in a large apartment, I would have about 100 people over. Some who were older would come in the early evening and have dinner, and that was always wonderful. A lot of the writers and theatrical people who were aging at that point, I was young, I was in my 20s, but I'd make them a vegan feast, and we would socialize, and then around 9 o'clock would come younger people, and by midnight, I'd have like three different groups, and after midnight, another group. And so I wanted to do an experiment. And I had people who were professional friends. I didn't socialize with them, but these are the people from, you know, William Morris Agency and my agent over there who had later become head of it, and a lot of other people in publishing. So the only thing we had in common was that I was their client, and I had multiple best-selling books, one after the other, after the other, after the other. I think at one time I had 41 straight. So they would come and celebrate the New Year's, and we'd chat. Now, they all drank. Now, they couldn't smoke in the apartment, so what I did is I went out and I got a bottle of the most expensive wine and the most expensive gin and the most expensive vodka I could. And I brought it back, and then I got the cheapest that I could. In fact, I got one with the vodka. Of course, I poured it out. And then I put water in there with just a little bit of lime. And so all night long, I put the bottle out there. All night long, people are drinking the same bottle. They're drinking water. But they're all talking about, how much this cost? Was this really $700 a bottle? I said, well, I can't tell you how much it was. It's not important. But it was expensive. So they were marveling and giving me all their critiques of how good the alcohol was when it, in point of fact, excuse me, I had the cheapest gin. I had like the $2 gin. No one knew what they were drinking. So the idea was, as long as you superimpose an image that something is more than what it actually is, people want that something else and then call it spectacular. It's much like watching these narcissistic shows that I refuse to watch, like the Academy Awards, where people are already making exorbitant amounts of money. Some, I think I was told, Daniel Craig's making $74 million for his upcoming James Bond film. And fine, if he can make it, that's his business. But we pay for that. That's going to cause the cost of that ticket to go up, probably $30 a ticket. And that'll exclude certain people from being able to afford that. But then they parade forward in their designer gowns. It's all about standing on the red carpet. It's all about behind the scenes having your publicist and your managers and your agents jockey to see that you get to interview this person, and they take all the photographs. It's just one really extended ego evening. And then when we see best movie or best direction or best documentary, that doesn't mean that it's the best. because you don't realize how much politicking went on behind the scenes by people spending millions of dollars to influence that 5,000-some Academy members to do the actual voting and what their biases are. And frequently, really good films don't get acknowledged for anything. But films that are needed to be acknowledged frequently are simply avoided. So we live by illusions all the time, all the time. And so my suggestion on this is that when it comes to something like living in the 1940s and 50s, even the 60s, understand the culture of our parents and to a greater degree also our grandparents. Understand that they could spend an evening drinking and smoking and eating TV dinners, right? Those terrible things. Or eating a meal they might have prepared that was not going to be healthy, but they thought it was. And then they didn't exercise. And they didn't have any appropriate ways of expressing their angst or their stress because men weren't supposed to show that they couldn't handle responsibilities. And women were thought to always have to be perfect. And then we had the stereotypes of the Aussie and Harriet and Father Knows Best and all these others, the Donna Reeds and those people who want you to see that everything is fine. There's nothing that we can't handle within the half hour of this show. We're going to show you a real example of life and how we have a problem and a solution and we laugh about it. But in the real world, that wasn't the case. So now imagine that if you're comparing those people with today, but a lot of those people are still living the same way. A lot of that was passed down and passed down and passed down. The reality is that only 2.7% of the American population are actively doing everything healthy. That means 97.3% are making themselves sick. So when you put that into the account, then you have a different reason for looking at diabetes. It's just not an insulin problem or just a high blood sugar problem. You've already created massive inflammation in every organ of your body, and you've been doing everything humanly possible to shorten your lifespan. So when we then see the breakdown of that system, including our metabolic system, and we diagnose it and call it diabetes, are we really just correcting blood sugar? That's all that the drugs do. Or are we doing what many people, many holistic doctors, nurses, chiropractors, naturopaths, and nutritionists have done? You change the entire lifestyle. You get the person exercising. You detoxify. You cleanse. You rejuvenate. And then not only do they no longer have diabetes, but even if they do have, for some reason, a higher blood sugar intake that day, it doesn't affect them at all. So that's why this study is so important. I believe it's a really good study because it tells us something we didn't otherwise know. And also, we'll finish up with Case Western Reserve University School did a study on the artificial sweetener Splenda, S-P-L-E-N-D-A, and they're saying it could intensify symptoms of those with Crohn's disease. Now, that's a really inflammatory condition in your gut. And so don't take Splenda. This was published in Inflammatory Bowel Diseases. But a lot of people are. Instead, take probiotics and cleanse. And cabbage juice is one of the best single things you can take for any itis, ileitis, colitis, in the intestines and the stomach. It also helps destroy the bacterium responsible for Helicobacter pylori. I'm Gary Noll. We're 24 minutes into our program. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Hey, say, wait a minute. Where are you going with that suitcase? Hey, wait a minute. Listen. All right, well, you don't have to answer. Just listen. I don't mind when you say that you're going away.
Yesterday, for those of you who were listening Over the telephone, you didn't have a problem. Your app, you didn't have a problem. But if you were listening over your internet, you did for a period of time, and that's because, unbeknownst, and we don't know why, an awful lot of people, beyond our normal very large bandwidth, came on board and crashed the system. We had all of our IT people working on it, and they resolved, they informed me later. We're back up and we've expanded it today. So thank all of the people for coming on. We're glad to have you with us. And we don't know why we had such a huge new number on, but we did. So we've corrected that. But just so that if it ever happens again, you don't miss any of the program, because I'm still broadcasting live. We're on syndicated stations and all over the world. Write down these two things. One, on your cell phone, there is an app. One of the apps in your store is PRN.FM. Just bring it onto your phone. That way you can hear crystal clear anywhere that your cell phone is operational. Secondly, I'm going to give you a phone number. This phone number will dial right in, and you can get us live every day. 424-203-8046. Again, please write it down. 424-203-8046. And you can also use your regular hardline phone. So that'll help you. Now, I'm going to start with the discussion called Stunning Fragility and Vindictive Political Correctness of Today's Students. I've mentioned the two people. It was on Charlie Rose, but he wasn't hosting it. Another person was Frank Bruni of the New York Times and Professor Jonathan Hett of New York University. I think they both make very important points. And why is this important? It's simple. Because in my world, I'd like to see us deal with issues that are really essential to our well-being, not only ours, but the planet, animals, and human beings everywhere. Here are the issues we are not dealing with, these young people are not dealing with. Now, if they were dealing with these also in a meaningful way, by not just theoretical, oh yeah, I belong to some group, I'm not sure what the group does, but I belong to it. No, what are you personally doing? Environmentally, the disposal of nuclear waste, hydrofracking on public lands, opening parks and natural refuges to fossil fuel companies and mining for them to exploit. We should be fighting that. Deforestation, it's massive and increasing. Deregulation of safety rules to health benefit the fossil fuel and chemical industries like the Koch brothers. Climate change denialism in Washington. Deregulation of factory livestock farms. Also on health, the opiate epidemic. Rising infant mortality rates in the United States, lead poisoning in water supplies of over 1,100 communities, equally bad or worse than Flint, Michigan. Not a word about it. Nothing's being done. Deregulation of toxic chemicals causing numerous illnesses. Ramping up the war on drugs instead of eliminating the war on drugs. New assaults on cannabis. Depression epidemic. We're not doing a thing about it. The epidemic of depression and anxiety disorders in our country. And suicide in all age groups, but especially the 24, more or less, anywhere from 22 to 24 American ex-servicemen taking their own lives each day, every 24 hours. The promotion of GMOs by the mainstream media and the government. Fast-tracking new drugs and new GMOs that we don't need. And the CDC as an intelligence agency rather than promoter of public health. Also the junk food and obesity epidemic. We're not doing a thing about it. On the socioeconomic front, the war on poverty is getting worse. Rising homelessness and fines to punish homelessness. Student debt. Debt prisons. Privatization of prisons. The tax bill benefiting really the wealthy. The new war against minorities and immigration policies. Attempts to turn the U.S. into a Christian theocracy. The agenda supporting white nationalism and racism. The failed public media industry. The corporatization of the judiciary, our judges, and just one more on foreign affairs, the militarization of the entire nation. The military is the number one beneficiary of all of our tax dollars. The ongoing attempts at regime change in Yemen, Venezuela, Syria, North Korea, and now Russia. A new nuclear weapons arsenal buildup. a foreign affairs agenda acting solely in the interests of private companies like Monsanto and Wall Street banks and the private defense industry. These are real, legitimate concerns. We're doing absolutely, positively nothing. If I go onto a college campus and I decide to talk about Yemen and how many people have color, how many babies have died, how many civilians have been killed, who was behind it, the people look at you like they don't know what you're talking about. You cannot have any depth of conversation on anything. It's essential to life. Everything is reduced to what is your age, what is your race, what is your gender, what is your social class. And I'm saying none of that is relevant to being a human being. Boy, we've come a long way from universities, colleges, preparing people for the real world, to taking a bubble that existed in the home and their local environments and bring it into the universities, then demanding they decide, the student decides, how a course should be taught, the language, the tone, the examples, and if any one of those is not perfect in every class, then the teacher should be thrown out. Listen then to what these two people have to say on this issue. I think it'll make it a lot clearer for you.
Good evening, I'm Dan Senor, filling in for Charlie Rose. Last Thursday, Middlebury College experienced a scene that's becoming increasingly familiar. Dr. Charles Murray, a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, was invited to speak. A massive protest greeted him, called the Heterodox Academy. Welcome to you both. I want to start with you, Frank. There's a lot to cover in this discussion. First of all, how did we get here? This incident with Dr. Murray at Middlebury was not the first time this has happened. We're seeing this all over the place. This didn't exist when you and I were going to college.
No.
What has happened?
Well, luckily, we're not seeing the kind of violence at Middlebury or at UC Berkeley everywhere, but we are seeing this desire to shut down speakers who are unwanted. And I think there are three things that come to mind above all others. One is we are living in an era, when you step away from campus, of increasingly partisan, polarized, vitriolic debate. So why wouldn't we see a heightened version of that on campuses, you know, among kids who are at the most passionate phase of life? I think it's also important to note that this is the generation that's the everybody gets a trophy generation, right? So no one modulates themselves or thinks I should kind of retire in the public space, let other people have their say, because everybody is, that's very individualist sentiment like that. And then lastly, and Jonathan, I think, can speak to this much better than I can, there's not a lot of ideological diversity on a lot of the campuses where this is happening. And so the notion that somebody with a perspective totally contrary to your own deserves the stage, deserves to be heard, that's sort of going away because there's so little diversity and there's so little appreciation for that, you know, really important ethos of education and of civil debate.
So what we're seeing in the last few years is the rise of a particular subgroup that is extremely passionate morally about equality, about fighting racism, and that's all great. But they've adopted a way that is kind of vindictive, that is all about calling people out. So people are afraid of them. And it's not just the students, it's actually the professors too. So even if it's only 5 or 10% on any campus, the fact that they can file charges against a professor.
Wow.
At NYU, we have a new bias response team. So any video I show, anything I say in class, if it offends a student, there's numbers all over in every bathroom urging them to call, report me. So that changes the way we teach. And then, as Frank said, if students aren't exposed to diverse ideas, then if somebody like Charles Murray comes, well, you know, he spoke at Middlebury 10 years ago and there was no big problem.
After his more controversial book, he's since then, his 2012 book, Coming Apart, which is he was supposed to
controversial. Yeah.
Much less controversial. That's what he was supposed to be speaking about.
Right, yeah. It's quoted in opinion columns of the New York Times.
It's
online.
On left and right.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
And it's the biggest problem of our age. I mean, why did Trump win? It's the coming apart of the by class.
It is a minority of students and it is a minority of schools. But they do set the tone. And at those schools where this is prevalent, it's really, really pronounced, and we're producing graduates who have little sense of the true ideological political diversity of American life. I went, within the last couple of years, want to be vague, to a very esteemed liberal arts college in the Northeast. And when I was there, the president had a dinner for me at the president's house, and all these faculty members went around the table and sang the praises of the school. And I heard about the affinity group they had for this group. I heard about XYZ. We got to the end. There were like 20 faculty members. At the end, they said, do you have any questions? And they were all boasting about what a diverse environment they had. And I had one question. I said, is there a group for Republican students? And they looked at me like it had never occurred to them. And there was one student there. And she said, I think there is, but they maybe have one member. Now, schools trip over themselves to get racial diversity. They give a lot of lip service to socioeconomic diversity, and some of them do better than others. But what about this whole other kind of diversity? How are we going to move forward as a country if many of our top schools are graduating kids who have no, who can't even begin to process how a human being could vote for Donald Trump? They need to understand right. who voted for Donald Trump and why, and that they're not monsters.
I think the best analogy here is to understand what's happening with peanut allergies. Why are peanut allergies rising? They've been rising at an alarming rate since the 90s. And so what do? We, you know, I take my kids to school. We get these long lectures on how we can't have any peanut butter in school.
And if you bring, I go through the Senate, if you bring them, you're basically expelled.
Yeah, that's right. Well, a report came out last year. Do you know why peanut allergies are rising? Because we haven't exposed kids to peanuts.
Right.
That's the reason they're rising. So the new recommendation is you got to give kids your peanuts early.
Right.
So this is what we've been doing.
There's in a metaphor
the name of.
There.
Right. No, it's not even a metaphor. I mean, it's the exact same psychological process. So Nassim Taleb has this wonderful book called Anti-Fragile. Kids are anti-fragile. So if you're fragile, that means like, oh, if I knock this, it'll break. Don't knock it.
Right.
But anti-fragile, like your bones, your brain, your personality, you need challenges, you need setbacks. You need to experience exclusion and insult in order to make it to adulthood. And the biggest problem, I think, is the loss of unsupervised play. So Lenore Skenazy has been brilliant on this with her book, Free Range Kids. You know, in our childhoods, after school, we spent time where there was no adult around. Right. But there was a real crime
wave. No after-school programming.
Yeah,
imagine that.
Right.
You just have to come home and kind of figure out how to keep yourself busy.
Yeah. That's right. And so, but in the, you know, in the 80s, there was a real crime wave. There were anti-bullying measures. There was a fear of abduction. So for a variety of reasons, kids basically were never out of adult oversight. And now in many towns, you can get arrested if your kid goes to the park to play.
Right.
So, you know, we can't be too tough on these kids. We, the older generation, we have deprived them of experience in the name of keeping them safe and happy and comfortable. We've deprived them of uncomfortable experiences with their peers. Mm-hmm. There's always an adult around. And so they come to campus. This is the last chance we could possibly give young Americans to learn to work out their differences. Right. And we don't do it. We have more and more deans and processes and bias response teams so that there's always an adult to call in to settle the problem.
This is the, to use the jargon of today, this is the helicopter parent producing the bubble-wrapped kid.
Right.
And when I did my college book about admissions to elite schools and all that, the complaint I heard most often from deans of admission, from college presidents at the very top schools in terms of selectiveness, was that these kids arrive on campus and they are overachievers by every metric that college is using. And the phrase that sticks with me is one admissions dean said, I am always amazed by the stunning fragility of these kids, which is exactly what Jonathan was talking about. And so what do? We give them these safe spaces. We construct these affinity groups. And debate about that is so shut down. I wrote a column not long ago asking the question, all of these colleges that put so much effort into bringing in a diverse class, once those kids are on campus, what do they do to actually promote interactions so that you have diverse interactions and don't affinity groups, don't safe spaces, don't those sort of work in the opposite direction? I was forwarded tweets where people were saying things like, I never knew Frank Bruni was such a racist. I was a racist because, asked how do Jonathan's colleagues react to him. When I talk to people in higher education, he's a hero because he's bringing up stuff about free speech and ideological diversity that they know needs to be bring. But they won't say that in the public square. Or they won't say the same things he's saying because they're so worried about a kind of shaming that the left right now, sadly, seems to specialize in.
Yeah, and I think this is really crucial. Mark Lilla had a piece in the New York Times right after the election on the problem of identity politics and how this may have alienated a lot of people and contributed to Trump's victory. And the response from many academics was ferocious. One of his colleagues at Columbia, within a few days, had some essay basically linking him to the Ku Klux Klan. But here's the point. So Lilla comes back with this brilliant point. He says, that's a slur, not an argument. And once he said that, I realized, oh, my God, that is exactly what has been happening to me. I've been saying some pretty provocative things, beginning with an Atlantic article with Greg Lukianoff, and I keep looking on the internet for people who will respond to it, and pretty much nobody is nobody's arguing against me for anything I say. But I do get a lot of people basically saying I'm a white male or I somehow am winking at racism, something like that. So young people who go through these colleges, they're exposed to a rhetorical training that prevents them from learning how to engage. They're trained carefully in how to basically discredit your opponent. Slur.
Right.
They learn to slur. They do not learn to argue.
So go look at the tape from Middlebury, and that's exactly what you see. You see students with their backs turned, right, and they're chanting slurs.
Okay, that's just one of many that I'm going to bring to you so that we can broaden the conversation. I had a person come up to me recently in an airport. I'm on the road, and I've been filming. I have another documentary that will be premiering in June, and then another documentary premiering in December. Very important social issues. And then I'm going to go out on the road, and I'm going to be filming The New Poverty. The documentary is called Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And it's not the historical poor. It's a whole lot of former working class, educated class, people who are the new poor, and they're invisible. So I intend to give them a forum to, in effect, as Lewis Hill would have suggested, give a voice to the voiceless. And that's what that'll be. And I'm going to invite some members of this audience who, depending upon where I'm at, which cities I'm hit, if you live in that area, you can come and sit in on the set and watch these interviews, because the interviews will take all day for several days in each city. In any case, this guy came over to me and he said, I saw you lecture about 10 years ago and really appreciated it, and my mom and dad follow your advice, and they're both extremely healthy. I said, how old are they? He said, well, my mom's 70, my dad's 74, and they're absolutely, you would think they're in their 40s or 50s. He said, I just got one question for you. He said, I'm a conservative, and I never let anyone at my campus. So I said, where do you go to school? He said, Berkeley. He said, I never let anyone know, because the moment you let someone know that you hold some conservative views, they're all over you. I mean, they're really angry. And so I just don't tell people. And I thought, wow, how unfortunate that people with different points of view cannot have civil conversations to at least discuss their differences and find, without arguing against the person, if you want to argue against an idea, that's fine. But this whole idea, well, like you just said, of using slurs and then having attacks on people's character because you disagree with something they said. And that's where we're at this moment. And unfortunately and regrettably, for those of us who grew up liberal and then morphed into a natural transition when we began to create the progressive movement in its current incarnation, where we don't align ourselves with either left or right. We just look for the truth. Wherever the truth is, that's what we want to promote, especially on social and humanistic ideals. And that just stuck in my mind when I was hearing this right now, that when he said how many people have been considered who have different points of view, and yeah, as long as you're not a conservative Republican, and I can debate a conservative Republican. You know, I'm going to do a whole discussion about how many people died in our next program, how many people died the new Common Dreams in the 15 years since we invaded Iraq. It's 2.4 million. Well, shouldn't that deserve the title of genocide? And shouldn't there be some international forums and open discussion about how we got there, who is responsible, and what we can do to prevent that in the future? Not a word. So when 2.4 million mainly civilians die that didn't have to over lies, and we just walk away from it, shame on us. Let's go over and say hello to my guest, who is standing by to take us on a little different journey right now. She's down in Washington, D.C. I gave you her bio a little earlier. Winona Hodder, she is the executive director of Food and Water Watch, which is a nonprofit that is looking out for how we can have cleaner, healthier food, safer water, and sustainable energy. And in addition to being one of the nation's leading health advocates, she also owns and operates an organic farm in Virginia, in the mountains of Virginia. Nice to have you with us today.
I'm so glad to be here.
Your organization, Food and Water Watch, has been one of the more important watchdogs of federal legislation threatening our water resources and our access to uncontaminated foods and fossil fuel technologies like fracking, mining, coal, nuclear, that threaten our health and the environment. We're witnessing a tornado wiping away consumer protections and regulations during the past year under Trump. And nothing was done under Obama, Bush, or Clinton to limit them. Just a few of the initiatives include a Dow Chemical lobbyist has been appointed to run the management of the most highly toxic Superfund sites in the EPA. The EPA dissolved the program that studies effects of chemical exposure on children. There was deregulation threatening the quality of our drinking water. The clean air policies are being withdrawn to so that the fossil fuel industries don't have to worry about their pollution. The EPA's methane rule is being rescinded, which applies to corporations drilling on public lands. Monsanto is being given carte blanche permission to continue its efforts at GMOs. And Trump's infrastructure plan will make all of this worse. So please take your time and summarize for us the White House's long-term agenda and the motivations behind these legislative actions, and what do they portend for the future health of Americans and the environment?
Well, I think that the Trump administration epitomizes all that we've been fighting for over the last couple of decades in deregulation and privatization, but they've brought it all to a head because Trump and his minions at the different agencies are going full speed ahead to reduce all of the hard-won protections that we have. I mean, we can just look at EPA as an example. By the time Trump's term is over, there will be a staff cut of about 50%, and we know that there had been already dramatic cuts over the last couple of decades. There's a war on science. They've even dismissed the science advisors that are part of a board that reviews what EPA scientists do. And if you look at energy, even though Tillerson, of course, has now been replaced by someone who is even worse, a darling of the Tea Party, what we've seen is that the Trump administration's goal is to facilitate more fossil fuel development and to really turn back any of the protections that there were, and we would at Food and Water Watch say that they were very weak under the Obama administration, and they're doing everything from loosening rules so there's more drilling, selling of mineral rights, expanding offshore drilling, having the largest oil and gas lease auctions on public lands and federal waters, and rolling back just about every protection, along with all of the other things that they are doing to impact social and environmental justice. So we are at a point where we need everyone to really be galvanized, both for the 2018 elections and beyond, to begin turning back this draconian agenda.
And how should they do that? Tell us how people in the audience can become involved.
Well, one of the things that really encourages me, because you can get very depressed about all of the losses that we've had, but I'm encouraged because the one thing that the Trump administration has brought us is a large constituency, people who've been involved in the resistance, but we say we have to take the resistance a step farther to real political involvement. And there's a role for this at the local, state, and federal level, both in terms of the election that's coming up in 2018, where we see more candidates running than ever before, candidates from a broad base, more Democrats. Of course, we don't want just any Democrat. We want people who are progressives, and that's been one of our problems, is that we haven't really held accountable people in both political parties. So some of those who should have been our allies have been part of this deregulation and privatization. But we have an opportunity now to really encourage some of these new young people and other people who are running for office. those who are not more inclined to do electoral politics, there is lots of room to do things at the local and state level. We, for instance, at Food and Water Watch, we have a new program around 100% renewable energy by 2035. And there are things that people can do in their own community to encourage their elected leaders, from city council to state legislator to the people that we're going to elect for Congress in 2018, to make it clear that they have to support a clean energy agenda. That's the only way we're going to get off of dirty fossil fuels and solve some of these many environmental catastrophes that we're facing, many of them driven by climate chaos.
I appreciate all the good work you do, and thank you for coming on for this Newsmaker update to remind people that our environment is extremely challenged, and we all have a responsibility to each other and the environment to become politically engaged. So Food and Water Watch is there to help us. They're doing a lot of the footwork. They're doing the scholarship, but they need our support. So give us again the contact information.
foodandwaterwatch.org.
Winona, thank you for all the good work you do. We look forward to our next update.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Winona Hauter, H-A-U-T-E-R, from Washington, D.C. Now, I'm going to open up the lines for our talk back right now, because if people in the audience have answers, positive solutions to any of the issues we've covered today, including helping the homeless. How so when there's an estimated 56,000 homeless in downtown Los Angeles alone? That's a huge number of people in that area. Call us at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And while you're calling in, and I'll get your calls when they come in, I was asked not long ago, if you wanted to move, what would be some of the places you would be best moving and where you wouldn't want to move because you wouldn't know all the real facts? According to Daisy Luther of Sleuth Journal, which is a good journal, here are the places that in the entire world are some of the worst. St. Louis, Baltimore, San Juan, Puerto Rico, New Orleans, and Detroit. These are just right here in the United States. So people have to know there's a lot of problems, far more problems than what they're able to deal with at this moment. And that does not include the impact of the environment. But for crime, and especially if you are an American and someone knows you're there, you're an easy target for kidnappers. Los Cabos, Mexico, Caracas, Venezuela, Acapulco, Mexico, Natal, Brazil, Tijuana, Mexico, La Paz, Mexico, Fortaleza, Brazil, Victoria, Mexico, and Belém, Brazil. Brazil's loaded with crime. In fact, outside of Rio, I wouldn't know a place in Brazil where you could feel reasonably safe at night and during the daytime. But then we just Cape Town, South Africa, Kingston, Jamaica, San Salvador, El Salvador, and Juarez, Mexico. Almost any place in Mexico is a bad place to visit if they can find out that you have money. And by the way, it's easy for them to find out you have money because you have to give your passport when you go into a hotel and frequently when you make your reservations. And then you could run into one of the 10 percenters. A 10 percenter is a person that works in a normal job in hotels and places that would have the background on you before you get there, then they pass it off to members of organized crime who then use the internet to find out, are you of value? Are your parents wealthy? Do you have savings? They can find all this out about you. And then you end up going to for a vacation where you go to, you know, see about living there and a cab picks you up. What you didn't know is all 30 cabs waiting at the airport are controlled by these organized crime. And instead of going to your hotel, they take you to a safe house. Now you're a problem. It's that bad, and the person who got this information is given 10%. So you're looking at Venezuela, you're looking at Brazil, Honduras, Mexico, Colombia. Yeah. Not places at this time, Durban, South Africa, that I would move to. And you have to be very conscientious about being in these places. You can't just go and be carefree. Thank you all for listening.